Shouldn't I have something to give her in return? I have already taken care of that, dear. She took a small velvet box from the table beside her chair. You will give her this. She handed the box to Geryon. Inside the box lay a silver amulet, a bit smaller than Geryon's own. Represented on its face in minute and exquisite detail was the likeness of that huge tree which stood in solitary splendor in the center of the Vale of Aldur. There was a crown woven into the branches. Geryon held the amulet in his right hand, trying to determine if it had some of the same kind of force about it that he knew was in the one that he wore. There was something there, but it did not feel at all the same.
It doesn't seem to be like ours, he concluded.
It isn't, Belgarath replied. Not exactly, anyway. Sinedra is not a sorceress, so she would not be able to use one like yours.
You said not exactly. It does have some kind of power, then?
It will give her certain insights, the old man answered, if she's patient enough to learn how to use it.
Exactly what are we talking about when we use the word insight?
An ability to see and hear things she would not otherwise be able to see or hear, Belgarath specified.
Is there anything else I should know about it before she gets here?
Just tell her that it is a family heirloom, Aunt Paul suggested.
It belonged to my sister, Belderan.
Oh, you should keep it, Aunt Paul, Geryon objected.
I can get something else for the princess.
No, dear, Belderan wants her to have it. Geryon found Aunt Paul's habit of speaking of people long dead, in the present tense, a trifle disconcerting, so he did not pursue the matter. There was a light tap on the door.
"Come in, Sinedra,"
Aunt Paul answered. The little princess was wearing a rather plain green gown, open at the throat, and her expression was somewhat subdued.
"Come over by the fire," Aunt Paul told her. "The evenings are still a bit chilly this time of year."
"Is it always this cold and damp in Arriva?"
Sinedra asked, coming to the fire.
"We are a long ways north of Tol Hanath," Geryon pointed out.
"I am aware of that,"
she said, with that little edge in her voice.
"I always thought it was customary to wait until after the wedding to start bickering," Belgarath observed slyly. "Have the rules changed?"
"Oh, just practicing, Belgarath,"
Sinedra replied impishly.
"Just practicing for later on."
The old man laughed.
"You can be a charming little girl when you put your mind to it."
Sinedra bowed mockingly. Then she turned to Geryon.
"It is customary for a Tolnedran girl to give her betrothed a gift of a certain value," she informed him.
She held up a heavy ornate ring set with several glowing stones.
"This ring belonged to Ranhorb II. The greatest of all Tolnedran emperors. Wearing it might help you to be a better king."
Geryon sighed. It was going to be one of those meetings.
"I'll be honored to wear the ring," he replied as
inoffensively as possible.
"And I would like for you to wear this."
He handed her the velvet box.
"It belonged to the wife of Reva Irongrip, Aunt Paul's sister."
Sinedra took the box and opened it.
"Why, Geryon,"
she exclaimed.
"It is lovely."
She held the amulet in her hand, turning it to catch the firelight.
"The tree. It looks so real that you can almost smell the leaves."
"Thank you," Belgarath replied modestly.
"You made it?"
The princess sounded startled. The old man nodded.
"When Polgara and Balderan were children, we lived in the Vale. There were not very many silversmiths there, so I had to make the amulets myself. Aldur helped me with some of the finer details."
"This is a priceless gift, Geryon."
The tiny girl actually glowed, and Geryon began to have some hope for his future.
"Help me with it,"
she commanded, handing him the two ends of the chain and turning with one hand, holding aside the mass of her deep red hair.
"Do you accept the gift, Senetra?"
Aunt Paul asked her, giving the question a peculiar emphasis.
"Well, of course I do,"
the princess replied.
"Without reservation? And of your own free will?"
Aunt Paul pressed, her eyes intent.
"I accept the gift, Lady Polgara,"
Tenedra replied.
"Fasten it for me, Geryon. Be sure it's secure. I would not want it to come undone."
"I don't think you'll need to worry too much about that," Belgareth told her.
Geryon's fingers trembled slightly as he fastened the curious clasp. His fingertips tingled peculiarly as the two ends locked together with a faintly audible click.
"Hold the amulet in your hand, Geryon," Aunt Paul instructed him.
Tenedra lifted her chin, and Geryon took the medallion in his right hand. Then Aunt Paul and Belgareth closed their hands over his. Something peculiar seemed to pass through their hands and into the talisman at Tenedra's throat.
"Now you are sealed to us, Tenedra,"
Aunt Paul told the princess quietly,
"with a tie that can never be broken."
Tenedra looked at her with a puzzled expression, and then her eyes slowly widened, and a dreadful suspicion began to grow in them.
"Take it off,"
she told Geryon sharply.
"He can't do that,"
Belgareth informed her, sitting back down and picking up his tankard again. Tenedra was tugging at the chain, pulling with both hands.
"You will just scratch your neck, dear," Aunt Paul warned gently. "The chain will not break. It cannot be cut. And it won't come off over your head. You will never have to worry about losing it." "You did this?"
the princess stormed at Geryon.
"Did what?" "Put this slave chain on me. It was not enough that I had to bow to you? Now you have put me in chains as well?"
"I didn't know," he protested.
"Liar!"
she screamed at him. Then she turned and fled the room, sobbing bitterly. Chapter 15. Geryon was in a sour mood. The prospect of another day of ceremony and tedious conferences was totally unbearable, and he had risen early to escape from the royal bedchamber before the insufferably polite appointment secretary, with his endless lists, could arrive to nail down the entire day. Geryon privately detested the inoffensive fellow, even though he knew the man was only doing his job. A king's time had to be organized and scheduled, and it was the appointment secretary's task to take care of that. And so, each morning after breakfast, there came that respectful tapping at the door, and the appointment secretary would enter, bow, and then proceed to arrange the young king's day, minute by minute. Geryon was morbidly convinced that somewhere, probably hidden away and closely guarded, was the ultimate master list that laid out the schedule for the rest of his life, including his royal funeral. But this day dawned too gloriously for thoughts of stuffy formality and heavy conference. The sun had come boiling up out of the sea of the winds, touching the snowfields atop the craggy peaks with a blushing pink, and the morning shadows in the deep valleys above the city were a misty blue. The smell of spring pushed urgently in from the little garden outside his window, and Geryon knew he must escape, if only for an hour or so. He dressed quickly in tunic, hose, and soft raven boots, rather carefully selecting clothes as unroyal as his wardrobe offered. Pausing only long enough to belt on his sword, he crept out of the royal apartment. He even considered not taking along his guards, but prudently decided against that. They were at a standstill in the search for the man who had tried to kill him in the dim hallway. But both Laldaran and Geryon had discovered that the outer garments of any number of Rivens needed repair. The gray cloak was not a ceremonial garment,
but rather was something thrown on for warmth. It was a sturdy utilitarian covering, and quite a number of such robes had been allowed to fall into a condition of shocking disrepair. Moreover, now that spring was here, men would soon stop wearing them, and the only clue to the attacker's identity would be locked away in a closet somewhere. Geryon brooded about that as he wandered moodily through the silent corridors of the citadel, with two mailed guards following at a respectful distance. The attempt, he reasoned, had not come from a Grolem. Aunt Paul's peculiar ability to recognize the mind of a Grolem would have alerted her instantly. In all probability, the attacker had not been a foreigner of any kind. There were too few foreigners on the island to make that very likely. It had to be Raven. But why would one of his own people want to kill the king, who had just returned after 1,300 years? He sighed with perplexity over the problem, and let his mind drift off to other matters. He wished that he were only Geryon again. He wished that more than anything. He wished that it might be possible for him to awaken in some out-of-the-way inn, somewhere, and start out in the silver light of daybreak to ride alone to the top of the next hill to see what lay beyond it. He sighed again. He was a public person now, and such freedom was denied to him. He was coldly certain that he was never going to have a moment to himself again. As he passed an open doorway, he suddenly heard a familiar voice.
Sin creeps into our minds the moment we let our thoughts stray, Ralg was saying.
Geryon stopped, motioning his guards to silence.
Must everything be a sin?
Tyba asked.
Inevitably, they were together. They had been together almost continually from the moment Ralg had rescued Tyba from her living entombment in the cave beneath Rakthal. Geryon was almost certain that neither of them was actually conscious of that fact. Moreover, he had seen evidence of discomfort not only on Tyba's face, but on Relg's as well, whenever they were apart. Something beyond the control of either of them drew them together.
"The world is filled with sin," Relg declared. "We must guard against it constantly. We must stand jealous guard over our purity against all forms of temptation."
"That would be very tiresome,"
Tyba sounded faintly amused.
"I thought you wanted instruction," Ralg accused her. "If you just came here to mock me, I will leave right now."
"Oh, sit down, Ralg," she told him. "We will never get anywhere with this if you take offense at everything I say."
"Have you no idea at all about the meaning of religion?" he asked after a moment.
He actually sounded curious about it.
"In the slave pens, the word religion meant death. It meant having your heart cut out."
"That was a Grolem perversion. Didn't you have a religion of your own?"
"The slaves came from all over the world, and they prayed to many gods, usually for death."
"What about your own people? Who is your god?"
"I was told that his name is Mara. We don't pray to him, though. Not since he abandoned us."
"It is not man's place to accuse the gods," Ralg told her sternly. "Man's duty is to glorify his god and to pray to him, even if the prayers are not answered."
"And what about the god's duty to man?"
she asked pointedly.
"Can a god not be negligent, as well as a man? Would you not consider a god negligent if he allowed his children to be enslaved and butchered? Or if he allowed his daughters to be given as a reward to other slaves when they pleased their masters, as I was?"
Ralg struggled with that painful question.
"I think that you have led a very sheltered life, Ralg.
I think you have a very limited idea of human suffering, of the kinds of things men can do to other men and women, apparently with the full permission of the gods.
You should have killed yourself.
Whatever for?
To avoid corruption, naturally.
You are an innocent, aren't you? I did not kill myself because I was not ready to die. Even in the slave pens, life can be sweet, Relg, and death is bitter. What you call corruption is only a small thing, and not even always unpleasant.
Sinful woman, he gasped.
You worry too much about that, Relg, she advised him. Cruelty is a sin. A lack of compassion is a sin. But that other little thing? I hardly think so. I begin to wonder about you. Could it be that this all of yours is not quite so stern and unforgiving as you seem to believe? Does he really want all these prayers and rituals and grovelings? Or are they your way to hide from your God? Do you think that praying in a loud voice and pounding your head on the ground will keep him from seeing into your heart?
Relg was making strangled noises.
If our gods really loved us, they would want our lives filled with joy,
she continued relentlessly.
But you hate joy for some reason, probably because you are afraid of it. Joy is not a sin, Relg. Joy is a kind of love, and I think the gods approve of it, even if you don't.
You are hopelessly depraved.
Perhaps so,
she admitted casually.
But at least I look life right in the face. I am not afraid of it, and I do not try to hide from it.
Why are you doing this?
He demanded of her, in an almost tragic voice.
Why must you forever follow me and mock me with your eyes?
I don't really know,
she replied, sounding almost puzzled.
You are not really that attractive. Since we left Rakthol, I have seen dozens of men who interested me much more. At first it was because I knew that I made you nervous, and because you were afraid of me. I rather enjoyed that. But lately there's more to it than that. It doesn't make any sense, of course. You are what you are, and I am what I am. But for some reason, I want to be with you.
She paused.
Tell me, Relg, and don't try to lie about it. Would you really want me to go away and never see you again?
There was a long and painful silence.
May Ul forgive me, Relg groaned finally.
I'm sure he will, Relg,
she assured him gently. Geryon moved quietly on down the corridor, away from the open door. Something he had not understood before had begun to become quite clear.
You are doing this, aren't you?
He asked silently.
Naturally,
the dry voice in his mind replied.
But why those two?
Because it was necessary, Belgarian.
I don't do things out of whim. We're all compelled by necessity, even I.
Actually, what's going on between Relg and Tyba does not remotely concern you. Geryon was a little stung by that.
I thought, well,
you assumed that you were my only care, that you were the absolute center of the universe. You're not, of course. There are other things almost equally important, and Relg and Tyba are centrally involved in one of those things. Your participation in that particular matter is peripheral, at the most.
They're going to be desperately unhappy if you force them together.
That does not matter in the slightest.
Their being together is necessary. You are wrong, though. It will take them a while to get used to it, but once they do, they are both going to be very happy. Obedience to necessity does have its rewards, after all.
Geryon struggled with that idea for a while, then finally gave up. His own problems intruded once more on his thoughts. Inevitably, as he always did when he was troubled, he went looking for Aunt Paul. He found her sitting before the cozy fire in her apartment, sipping a cup of fragrant tea and watching through the window as the rosy morning sunlight set the snowfields above the city ablaze.
"You are up early," she observed as he entered. "I wanted to talk to you. And the only way I ever get the chance to do what I want is to leave my room before the man with my schedule for the day shows up."
He flung himself into a chair.
"They never give me a minute to myself." "You're an important person now, dear." "Well, that wasn't my idea."
He stared moodily out the window.
"Grandfather's all right now, isn't he?"
he asked suddenly.
"What gave you that idea?" "Well, the other day, when we gave Tenedra the amulet, didn't he sort of—"
"Most of that came from you, dear," she replied.
"I felt something else."
"That could have been just me. It was a pretty subtle thing, and even I could not be sure if he had any part in it."
"Well, there has to be some way we can find out."
"There is only one way, Geryon, and that is for him to do something."
"All right. Let's go off with him someplace and have him try. Something sort of small, maybe."
"And how would we explain that to him?"
"You mean he doesn't know?"
Geryon sat up quickly.
"He might, but I rather doubt it."
"You didn't tell him?"
"Of course not. If he has any doubts whatsoever about his abilities, he will fail. And if he fails once, that will be the end of it."
"I don't understand."
"A very important part of it is knowing that it's going to work. If you are not absolutely sure, then it won't. That is why we cannot tell him."
Geryon thought about that.
"I suppose that makes sense. But isn't it sort of dangerous? I mean, if something really urgent comes up, and he tries to do something about it, and we all of a sudden find out that he can't."
"You and I would have to deal with it then, dear.
Well, you seem awfully calm about it."
"Getting excited doesn't really help very much, Geryon."
The door burst open, and Queen Layla, her hair all awry and her crown slipping precariously over one ear, stormed in.
"I won't have it, Polgara," she declared angrily. "I absolutely won't have it. You have got to talk to him. Oh, excuse me, Your Majesty,"
the plump little queen added, noticing Geryon.
"I didn't see you."
She curtsied gracefully.
"Your Highness,"
Geryon replied, getting up hurriedly and bowing in return.
"Who do you wish me to speak with, Layla?"
Aunt Paul asked.
"Anheg. They insist that my poor husband sit up and drink with him every night. Falrak's so sick this morning that he can barely lift his head off the pillow. That great bully of a Kerrick is ruining my husband's health."
"Anheg likes your husband, Layla. It is his way of showing his friendship."
"Oh, can't they be friends without drinking so much?"
"I'll talk to him, dear,"
Aunt Paul promised. Mollified somewhat, Queen Layla departed, curtsying again to Geryon. Geryon was about to return to the subject of Belgoroth's infirmity when Aunt Paul's maid came in to announce Lady Merrill. Barak's wife entered the room with a somber expression.
"Your Majesty,"
she greeted Geryon perfunctorily. Geryon rose again to bow and politely respond. He was getting rather tired of it.
I need to talk with you, Polgara,
Merrill declared.
Of course,
Aunt Paul replied. Would you excuse us, Geryon?
I'll wait in the next room, he offered. He crossed to the door, but did not close it all the way. Once again his curiosity overcame his good manners.
They'll keep throwing it in my face,
Merrill blurted, almost before he was out of the room.
And what's that?
Well,
Merrill hesitated, then spoke quite firmly.
My lord and I were not always on the best of terms, she admitted.
Oh, that's widely known, Merrill, Aunt Paul told her diplomatically.
That's the whole problem, Merrill complained. They all keep laughing behind their hands and waiting for me to go back to being the way I was before.
A note of steel crept into her voice.
Well, it's not going to happen, she declared. So they can laugh all they want to. I'm glad to hear it, Merrill,
Aunt Paul replied.
Oh, Polgara,
Merrill said with a helpless little laugh.
He looks so much like a great shaggy bear, but he's so gentle inside. Why couldn't I have seen that before, all those years wasted?
You had to grow up, Merrill. It takes some people longer, that is all.
After Lady Merrill had left, Geryon came back in and looked quizzically at Aunt Paul.
Has it always been like that?
What I mean is, do people always come to you when they've got their problems?
It happens now and then. People seem to think that I'm very wise. Usually they already know what they have to do, so I listen to them and agree with them, and give them a bit of harmless support. It makes them happy. I set aside a certain amount of time each morning for these visits. They know that I am here if they feel the need for someone to talk to. Would you care for some tea?
He shook his head.
Isn't it an awful burden? All these other people's problems, I mean.
Oh, it's not really that heavy, Geryon. Their problems are usually rather small and domestic. It's rather pleasant to deal with things that aren't quite so earth-shaking.
Besides, I don't mind visitors, whatever their reasons for coming.
The next visitor, however, was Queen Aethlina, and her problem was more serious. Geryon withdrew again when the maid announced that the Queen of Kharrik wished to speak privately with Lady Polgara, but as before, his curiosity compelled him to listen at the door of the adjoining chamber.
I've tried everything I can think of, Polgara, but Grodek won't let me go.
The High Priest of Balar?
He knows everything, naturally,
Aethlina confirmed.
All his underlings reported my every indiscretion to him. He threatens to tell Anheg if I try to sever my connection with the Bear Cult. How could I have been so stupid? He's got his hands around my throat.
Just how indiscreet have you been, Aethlina?
Aunt Paul asked the Queen pointedly.
I went to some of their rituals,
Aethlina confessed.
I put a few cult members in positions in the palace. I passed some information along to Grodek.
Which rituals, Aethlina?
Oh, not those, Polgara,
Aethlina replied in a shocked voice.
I would never stoop to that.
So all you really did was attend a few harmless gatherings where people dress up in bearskins and let a few cultists into the palace, where there were probably a dozen or more already anyway, and pass on a bit of harmless palace gossip.
It was harmless, wasn't it? I didn't pass on any state secrets, Polgara, if that's what you mean.
Then Grodek does not really have any hold over you, Aethlina.
Oh, what should I do, Polgara?
The Queen asked in an anguished voice.
Go to Anheg. Tell him everything. But I can't.
You must.
Otherwise Grodek will force you into something worse.
Actually, the situation could be turned to Anheg's advantage.
Tell me exactly how much you know about that cult's doing.
They've begun creating chapters among the peasants, for one thing.
They've never done that before,
Aunt Paul mused.
The cult has always been restricted to the nobility and the priesthood. I can't be sure, but I think they're preparing for something major, some kind of confrontation.
I'll mention it to my father. I think that he will want to take steps. As long as the cult was the plaything of the priesthood and the minor nobility, it was not really all that important. But rousing the peasantry, that's quite another thing.
I've heard a few other things as well,
Elena continued.
I think they're trying to penetrate Rodar's intelligence service. If they can get a few people in the right places in Boktor, they'll have access to most of the state secrets of the West.
I see. Aunt Paul's voice was as cold as ice.
I heard Grodeg talking once,
Elena said in a tone of distaste.
It was before he found out that I didn't want anything more to do with him. He had been reading the auguries and the signs of the heavens, and he was talking about the return of the Riven King. The cult takes the term Overlord of the West quite seriously. I honestly believe that their ultimate goal is to elevate Belgarion to the status of Emperor of all of the West, Aloria, Sindaria, Arindia, Tonedra, and Nyssa.
That's not how the term was meant to be interpreted, Aunt Paul objected.
I know, but Grodeg wants to twist it until it comes out that way. He is a total fanatic, and he wants to convert all of the people of the West to Balar by the sword, if necessary.
That idiot, Aunt Paul raged. He would start a general war in the West if he tried that, and even set the gods to wrangling. Oh, what is there about Aelons that makes them continually want to expand to the South? Those boundaries were established by the gods themselves. I think it is time for someone to put his foot down on Grodig's neck. Firmly. Go to Anhig immediately. Tell him everything. And then tell him that I want to see him. I imagine that my father's going to want to discuss the matter with him as well.
Anhig's going to be furious with me, Polgara,
Elena faltered.
I don't think so,
Aunt Paul assured her. As soon as he realizes that you have exposed Grodig's plan, he will probably be rather grateful. Let him think that you went along with Grodeg simply to get more information. That is a perfectly respectable motive, and it is the sort of thing a good wife would do.
I hadn't thought of that,
Elena said, already sounding more sure of herself.
It would have been a brave thing to do, wouldn't it?
Absolutely heroic, Elena, Aunt Paul replied. Now, go to Anhag.
I will, Pogra.
There was the sound of quick, determined steps, and then a door closed.
Geryon, come back in here.
Aunt Paul's voice was firm. He opened the door.
You were listening?
It wasn't really a question.
Well, we are going to have to talk about that, she told him. But it doesn't really matter this time. Go find your grandfather and tell him that I want to see him immediately. I do not care what he is doing. Bring him to me now.
But how do we know he can do anything?
Geryon demanded.
I mean, if he's lost his power. There are many kinds of power, Geryon. Sorcery is only one of them. Now go fetch him at once.
Yes, Aunt Paul,
Geryon replied, already moving toward the door. Chapter 16. The High Priest of Balar was an imposing-looking man, nearly 7 feet tall. He had a long gray beard and burning eyes sunk deep in their sockets beneath bristling black eyebrows. He arrived from Val Elon the following week, after the seemingly endless negotiations had finally produced the official betrothal document. Accompanying him as a kind of retinue were 2 dozen hard-faced warriors dressed in bear skins.
"Bear cultists,"
Barak observed sourly to Geryon and Silk, as the 3 of them stood atop the wall of the citadel, watching the high priest and his men mounting the steps from the harbor in the bright spring sunshine.
"I didn't say anything about bringing soldiers with him,"
Geryon objected indignantly. I imagine. He took it upon himself, Silk replied. Grodeg's very good at taking things upon himself.
I wonder how he would like it if I threw him into a dungeon,
Geryon said hotly.
Do I have a dungeon?
We could improvise one, I suppose,
Brak grinned at him.
Some nice damp cellar someplace. You might have to import rats, though. The island is reputed to be free of them.
You're making fun of me,
Geryon accused his friend, flushing slightly.
No, you know I wouldn't do that, Geryon, Brak replied, pulling at his beard.
I would talk with Belgareth before I had Grodeg clapped in irons, though, Silk suggested. The political implications might go a bit further than you intend. Whatever you do, don't let Grodeg talk you into letting him leave any of his men behind. He's been trying to get a foothold on the Isle of the Winds for 20 years now. Not even Brand has had the nerve to let him go that far.
Brand? Isn't it obvious?
I would not want to say that Brand's a cult member, but his sympathies certainly lie in that direction.
Geryon was shocked at that, and a little sick.
What do you think I ought to do?
Don't try to play politics with these people.
That's right. Grodeg's here to conduct the official betrothal ceremony. Just let it go at that.
He will try to talk to me, though,
Geryon fretted.
He's going to try to make me lead an invasion into the southern kingdoms so that he can convert the Arryns and Tonedrans and Naesans to the worship of Balar.
Where did you hear that?
Silk asked curiously.
I would rather not say, Geryon evaded.
Does Belgareth know?
Geryon nodded.
Aunt Paul told him.
Silk chewed thoughtfully on a fingernail.
Just be stupid, he said finally.
What?
Pretend to be a simple country bumpkin with no idea of what's going on. Grodeg's going to do everything he can to get you alone, so he can wring concessions out of you. Just keep smiling and nodding foolishly. And every time he makes a proposal, send for Belgareth. Let him think that you can't make a single decision on your own.
Won't that make me seem... well...
Do you really care what he thinks?
Well, not really, I guess, but...
It will drive him crazy,
Brak pointed out with a wicked grin.
He'll think that you're a complete idiot, a ripe plum ready for the picking. But he'll realize that if he wants you, he will have to fight Belgareth to get you. He will be tearing out his beard in frustration before he leaves.
He turned and looked admiringly at Silk.
That's a really terrible thing to do to a man like Grodeg, you know.
Silk smirked.
Isn't it, though?
The three of them stood grinning at each other and finally burst into laughter. The official betrothal ceremony was conducted the following day. There had been a great deal of haggling about who should enter the Hall of the Riven King first, but that difficulty had been overcome by Belgareth's suggestion that Geryon and Tenedra could enter arm in arm.
"This is all in preparation for a wedding, after all," he had pointed out. "We might as well start off with a semblance, at least, of friendship."
Geryon was very nervous as the hour approached. His princess had been smoldering since the incident with the amulet, and he was almost certain that there was going to be trouble. But to his surprise, Tenedra was radiant as the two of them waited alone together in a small antechamber while the official guests gathered in the hall. Geryon fidgeted a great deal, walking up and down nervously, adjusting his clothing. But Tenedra sat rather demurely, patiently waiting the trumpet fanfare, which was to announce their entrance.
"Geryon?"
she said after a while.
Yes. Do you remember that time we bathed together in the Wood of the Dryads?
We did not bathe together, Geryon replied quickly, blushing to the roots of his hair.
Well, very nearly.
She brushed his distinction aside.
Do you realize that Lady Polgara kept throwing us together like that all of the time that we were traveling? She knew that all of this was going to happen, didn't she?
Yes,
Geryon admitted.
So she kept shoving us at each other, hoping something might happen between us.
Geryon thought about that.
You're probably right, he concluded. She likes to arrange people's lives for them.
Zinedra sighed.
Oh, look at all the opportunities we missed,
she said somewhat regretfully.
Zinedra,
Geryon gasped, shocked at her suggestion. She giggled a bit wickedly. Then she sighed again.
Now it's all going to be dreadfully official. Probably not nearly as much fun.
Geryon's face was flaming by now.
Anyway, that time we bathed together, do you remember that I asked you if you would like to kiss me?
Geryon nodded, not trusting himself to speak.
I never got that kiss, you know,
she said archly, standing up and crossing the small room to him.
And I think I'd like it now.
She took hold of the front of his doublet firmly with both little hands.
You owe me a kiss, Belgarian of Riva, and a Tonedrin always collects what people owe her.
The look she directed up through her lashes at him smoldered dangerously. Just outside, the trumpets blared out an extended fanfare.
We're supposed to go in now,
Geryon sputtered a bit desperately.
Let them wait,
she murmured, her arms sliding up around his neck. Geryon tried for a quick perfunctory kiss, but his princess had other ideas. Her little arms were surprisingly strong, and her fingers locked in his hair. The kiss was lingering, and Geryon's knees began to tremble.
There,
Zinedra breathed, when she finally released him.
We'd better go in,
Geryon suggested, as the trumpets blared again.
In a moment. Did you muss me?
She turned around so that he could inspect her.
No,
he replied.
Everything still seems to be in order.
She shook her head rather disapprovingly.
Try to do a little better next time,
she told him.
Otherwise, I might start to think that you're not taking me seriously.
I'm never going to understand you, Zinedra.
I know,
she said with a mysterious little smile. Then she patted his cheek gently.
And I am going to do everything I can to keep it that way. Shall we go in? We really shouldn't keep our guests waiting, you know.
That's what I said in the first place.
We were busy then,
she declared, with a certain grand indifference.
Just a moment.
She carefully smoothed his hair.
There. That's better. Now, give me your arm.
Geryon extended his arm, and his princess laid her hand on it. Then he opened the door to the third chorus from the trumpets. They entered the hall, and an excited buzz ran through the crowd assembled there. Taking his cue from Zinedra, Geryon moved at a stately pace, his face sober and regal-looking.
Not quite so grim,
she whispered.
Smile just a little, and nod occasionally. It's the thing to do.
If you say so,
he replied.
I really don't know too much about this sort of thing.
Oh, you'll be just fine,
she reassured him. Smiling and nodding to the spectators, the royal couple passed through the hall to the chair that had been placed near the front for the princess. Geryon held the chair for her, then bowed and mounted the dais to his throne. As always happened, the orb of Aldur began to glow as soon as he sat down. This time, however, it seemed to have a faint pink cast to it. The official betrothal ceremony began with a rolling invocation delivered in a thunderous voice by the High Priest of Belar. Grodeg took a full advantage of the dramatics of the situation.
Tiresome old windbag, isn't he?
Belgarath murmured from his accustomed place at the right of the throne.
"What were you and Sinedra doing in there?"
Aunt Paul asked Geryon.
"Nothing,"
Geryon replied, blushing furiously.
"Really? And it took you all that time? How extraordinary."
Grodug had begun reading the first clauses of the betrothal agreement. To Geryon they sounded like pure gibberish. At various points, Grodug stopped his reading to look sternly at Geryon.
"Does His Majesty, Belgarion of Riva, agree to this?"
he demanded each time.
"I do,"
Geryon replied.
"Does Her Highness, Tenedra, of the Tornedran Empire, agree to this?"
Grodug asked the princess. Tenedra responded in her clear voice.
"I do."
"How are you two getting along?"
Belgarath asked, ignoring the droning voice of the clergyman.
"Who knows?" Geryon answered helplessly. "I can't tell from one minute to the next what she's going to do." "That's the way it's supposed to be, dear,"
Aunt Paul told him.
"I don't suppose that you would consider explaining that." "No, dear,"
she replied, with a smile as mysterious as Sinedra's had been.
"I didn't really think so,"
he mumbled. Geryon thought about Sinedra's rather open invitation to Musser during the interminable reading of the document which was firmly nailing down the remainder of his life, and the more he thought about it, the more he found the notion of a bit of polite mussing attractive. He rather hoped that the princess would linger after the ceremony, and that they might go someplace private to discuss it. Following Grodeg's pompous benediction, however, Zenedra was immediately surrounded by all of the younger girls of the court and swept away for some private celebration of their own. From all of the giggling and wicked little glances cast in his direction, he concluded that the conversation at their little get-together was going to be very frank, probably naughty, and that the less he knew about it, the better. As Silkenberg had predicted, the High Priest of Velar tried several times to speak to Geryon privately. Each time, however, Geryon put on a great show of ingenuousness and sent immediately for Belgarath. Grodug left the island with his entire retinue the following day. To add a final insult to the whole matter, Geryon insisted that he and Belgarath accompany the fuming ecclesiast to his ship to see him off. And to be certain that no bear cultist might inadvertently be left behind.
"Whose idea was all of this?"
Belgarath inquired, as he and Geryon climbed the steps back to the citadel.
"Silk and I worked it out," Geryon replied smugly.
"I might have known."
"I thought things went quite well," Geryon congratulated himself.
"You have made yourself a dangerous enemy, you know."
"We can handle him."
"You're getting to be very free with that we, Geryon,"
Belgarath said disapprovingly.
"We are all in this together, aren't we, Grandfather?"
Belgarath looked at him helplessly for a moment and then began to laugh. In the days that followed Grodeg's departure, however, there was little occasion for laughter. Once the official ceremonies were over, the Ilorn kings, King Fulrak, and various advisers and generals got down to business. Their subject was war.
"The most recent reports I have from Thorn Murgos indicate that Tar Ogas is preparing to move the southern Murgos up from Rakhaga as soon as the weather breaks on the eastern coast,"
King Rodar advised them.
"And in Adrax?"
King Anheg asked.
"They appear to be mobilizing, but there is always a question about the Nadrax. They play their own game, so it takes a lot of Grolems to whip them into line. The Turls just obey orders."
"The Turls don't really concern anyone,"
Brand observed.
"The key to the whole situation is how many Melorians are going to be able to take the field against us."
"There's a staging area for them being set up at Sol Zelek,"
Rodar reported.
But they are also waiting for the weather to break in the Sea of the East. King Anhag frowned thoughtfully.
Mothorians are bad sailors, he mused. They won't move until summer. And they'll hug the north coast all the way to Tulzelek. We need to get a fleet into the Sea of the East as soon as possible. If we can sink enough of their ships and drown enough of their soldiers, we might be able to keep them out of the war entirely. I think we should strike in force into Garag Nadrak. Once we get into the forest, my men can build ships. We will sail down the River Cordu and out into the Sea of the East.
Thy plan has merit, Your Majesty, Mandarallan approved, studying the large map hanging on the wall. The Nadraks are fewest in number, and farthest removed from the hordes of southern Cthal Murgos.
King Rhodar shook his head stubbornly. I know you want to get into the sea as quickly as possible, Anhag, but you are committing me to a campaign in the Nadrak forest. I need open country to maneuver in. If we strike at the Tulls, we can cut directly across to the upper reaches of the River Mardu, and you can sail on down to the sea that way.
There aren't that many trees in Mishrak Achtul, Anhag protested.
Why build ships out of green lumber if you don't have to? Why not sell up the Aldur and then portage across? Rhodar asked.
You want my men to portage ships up the eastern escarpment? Rhodar, be serious.
We have engineers, Anhag. They can devise ways to lift your ships to the top of the escarpment.
Geryon did not want to intrude his inexperience on the conference, but the question came out before he had time to think about it.
Have we decided where the final battle's going to be?
Which final battle was that, Geryon?
When we meet them head-on. Like Vomembre.
There won't be a Vomembre in this war, Anhag told him.
Not if we can help it. Vomembre was a mistake, Geryon,
Mogoroth said quietly.
We all knew it, but there wasn't anything that we could do about it.
We won, didn't we?
That was pure luck, and you cannot plan a campaign on the hope that you might get lucky. Nobody wanted the battle at Vomembre. We didn't, and Kaltorak didn't. But nobody had any choice in the matter. We had to commit to battle before the second Angrak column arrived in the west. Kaltorak had been holding the southern Murgos and eastern Malorians in reserve near Rakhaga. They started to march when he turned west from the siege of the stronghold. If they had been able to join forces with Kaltorak, there would not have been enough men in all of the west to meet them. So we had to fight. Vomembre was the least objectionable battlefield.
Why didn't Kaltorak just wait until they arrived?
You cannot stop an army in unfriendly territory, King Balgarian, Colonel Brendig explained. You'll have to keep moving, or the local populace destroys all of the food and starts coming out at night to cut up your people. You can lose half your army that way.
Kaltorak did not want the meeting at Vomembre any more than we did,
Belgarath went on. The column from Rakhaga got caught in a spring blizzard in the mountains. They were bogged down for weeks. They finally had to turn back. Torak was forced to fight at Vomembre, without any advantage of numbers, and nobody in his right mind goes into battle that way.
My force should be larger by a quarter than thine adversaries, Mandarallan agreed. Else the outcome must be in doubt. By a third, Barak corrected in a rumbling voice. By half, if you can arrange it.
Then all we are going to do is spread out all over the eastern half of the continent and fight a whole series of little battles?
Geryon demanded incredulously.
That could take years. Decades.
It could go on for a century.
If it has to, Belgarath told him bluntly. What did you expect, Geryon? A short little ride in the sunshine? A nice easy fight, and then home before winter? I am afraid it won't be like that. You had better get used to wearing armor and a sword, because you will probably be dressed that way for most of the rest of your life. This is likely to be a very long war.
Geryon's illusions were crumbling rapidly. The door to the council room opened then, and Olban, Bran's youngest son, entered and spoke with his father. The weather had turned blustery, and a spring storm was raking the island. Olban's gray riven cloak was dripping as he entered. Dismayed by the prospect of year after year of campaigning in the east, Geryon distractedly stared at the puddle forming around Olban's feet as the young man talked quietly with Brand. Then, out of habit, he lifted his eyes slightly to look at the hem of Olban's cloak. There was a small tear on the left corner of the cloak, and a scrap of cloth seemed to be missing. Geryon stared at the telltale rip for a moment, without realizing exactly what it was he was seeing. Then he went suddenly cold. With a slight start, he jerked his eyes up to look at Olban's face. Bran's youngest son was perhaps Geryon's own age, a bit shorter but more muscular. His hair was pale blonde, and his young face was serious, reflecting already the customary raven gravity. He seemed to be trying to avoid Geryon's eyes, but showed no other sign of nervousness. Once, however, he looked inadvertently at the young king and seemed to flinch slightly as guilt rose clearly into his eyes. Geryon had found the man who had tried to kill him. The conference continued after that, but Geryon did not hear any more of it. What was he to do? Had Olban acted alone, or were others involved? Had Brand himself been a part of it? It was so difficult to know what a Riven was thinking. He trusted Brand, but the big warder's connection with the bear cult gave a certain ambiguity to his loyalties. Could Grodeg be behind all of this? Or perhaps a Grolem? Geryon remembered the Earl of Yarvik, whose soul had been purchased by Ashrak, and who had mounted rebellion in Val-Alorn. Had Olban fallen, perhaps, under the spell of the blood-red gold of Angarak, as Yarvik had? But Riva was an island, the one place in the world where no Grolem could ever come. Geryon discounted the possibility of bribery. In the first place, it was not in the Riven character. In the second, Olban had not likely ever been in a situation to come into contact with a Grolem. Rather grimly, Geryon decided on a course of action. Lalduran, of course, had to be kept out of it. The hot-headed young Astorian was incapable of the kind of delicate discretion that seemed to be called for. He would reach for his sword, and the whole business would disintegrate rather rapidly after that. When the conference broke up for the day late that afternoon, Geryon went to look for Olban. He did not take a guard with him, but he did wear his sword. As chance had it, it was in a dim corridor not unlike the one where the assassination attempt had taken place that the young king finally ran Bran's youngest son down. Olban was coming along the passageway in one direction, and Geryon was going the other. Olban's face paled slightly when he saw his king, and he bowed deeply to hide his expression. Geryon nodded as if intending to pass without speaking, but turned after the two of them had gone by each other. "Olban," he said quietly. Bran's son turned, a look of dread on his face. "I noticed that the corner of your cloak is torn," Geryon said, in an almost neutral tone. "When you take it to have it mended, this might help." He took the scrap of cloth out from under his doublet and offered it to the pale-faced young Riven.
Olben stared, wide-eyed at him, not moving.
"And as long as we are at it," Geryon continued, "you might as well take this, too. I think you dropped it somewhere."
He reached inside his doublet again and took out the dagger with its bent point. Olben started to tremble violently, and then he suddenly dropped to his knees.
"Please, Your Majesty," he begged. "Let me kill myself. If my father finds out what I've done, it'll break his heart."
"Why did you try to kill me, Olben?"
"For love of my father,"
Bran's son confessed, tears welling up in his eyes.
"He was ruler here in Raven until you came. Your arrival degraded him. I couldn't bear that. Please, Your Majesty, don't have me dragged to the scaffold like a common criminal. Give me the dagger. I'll bury it in my heart right here. Spare my father this last humiliation."
"Don't talk nonsense," Geryon told him. "Get up. You look silly down there on your knees."
"Your Majesty,"
Olban began to protest.
"Oh, be still," Geryon told him irritably. "Let me think for a moment."
Dimly, he began to see the glimmer of an idea.
"All right. This is what we're going to do. You are going to take this knife and this wool scrap down to the harbor and throw them into the sea. And then, you are going to go on about your life as if this had never happened."
"Your Majesty?"
"I'm not finished. Neither you nor I will ever speak of this again. I don't want any hysterical public confessions, and I absolutely forbid you to kill yourself. Do you understand me, Olban?"
Dumbly, the young man nodded.
"I need your father's help too much to have this come out, or for him to be distracted by personal tragedy. This did not happen, and that's an end of it. Take these. Get out of my sight."
He shoved the knife and the wool scrap into Olban's hands. He was suddenly infuriated. The weeks of looking nervously over his shoulder had all been so unnecessary, so useless.
"Oh, one other thing, Olban," he added as the stricken young Revan turned to leave. "Don't throw any more knives at me. If you want to fight, let me know. We will go someplace private and cut each other to ribbons, if that's what you want."
Olban fled, sobbing.
"Very well done, Belgerian,"
the dry voice complimented him.
"No, shut up,"
Geryon said. He slept very little that night. He had a few doubts about the wisdom of the course he had taken with Olban, but on the whole, he was satisfied that what he had done had been right. Olban's act had been no more than an impulsive attempt to erase what he believed to be his father's degradation. There had been no plot involved in it. Olban might resent Geryon's magnanimous gesture, but he would not throw any more daggers at his king's back. What disturbed Geryon's sleep the most during that restless night was Belgarath's bleak appraisal of the war upon which they were about to embark. He slept briefly on toward dawn, and awoke from a dreadful nightmare with icy sweat standing out on his forehead. He had just seen himself, old and weary, leading a pitifully small army of ragged, gray-haired men into battles that they could not possibly win.
"There is an alternative, of course, if you've recovered enough from your bout of peevishness to listen,"
the voice in his mind advised him as he sat bolt upright and trembling in his bed.
"What?" Geryon answered aloud. "Oh, that. I'm sorry I spoke that way. I was irritated, that's all."
"In many ways, you are like Belgarath. Remarkably so. This irritability seems to be hereditary."
"It is only natural, I suppose," Geryon conceded. "You said there was an alternative? An alternative to what?"
to this war that's giving you nightmares. Get dressed. I want to show you something.
Geryon climbed out of his bed and hastily jerked on his clothing.
Where are we going?
He asked, still speaking aloud.
It isn't far.
The room to which the other awareness directed him was musty and showed little evidence of use. The books and scrolls lining the shelves along its walls were dust-covered, and cobwebs draped the corners. Geryon's lone candle cast looming shadows that seemed to dance along the walls.
On the top shelf, the voice told him. The scroll, wrapped in yellow linen. Take it down.
Geryon climbed up on a chair and took down the scroll.
What is this?
He asked.
The Mren Codex. Take off the cover and start unrolling it. I'll tell you when to stop.
It took Geryon a moment or two to get the knack of unrolling the bottom of the scroll with one hand and rolling the top up with the other.
There, the voice said. That's the passage. Read it.
Geryon struggled over the words. The script was spidery, and he still did not read very well.
It doesn't make any sense, he complained.
The man who wrote it down was insane, the voice apologized. And he was an imbecile besides. But he was all I had to work with. Try it again, out loud.
Geryon read.
Behold, it shall come to pass that in a certain moment, that which must be, and that which must not be, shall meet. And in that meeting shall be decided all that has gone before, and all that will come after. Then will the child of light and the child of dark face each other in the broken tomb, and the stars will shudder and grow dim.
Geryon's voice trailed off.
It still doesn't make any sense,
he objected.
It is a bit obscure, the voice admitted. As I said, the man who wrote it was insane. I put the ideas there, but he used his own words to express them.
Who is the child of light?
Geryon asked.
You are.
For the moment, at least. It changes.
Me?
Of course.
Then who's this child of dark that I'm supposed to meet?
Torak.
Torak?
I should have thought that would be obvious by now. I told you once about the two possible destinies coming together finally. You and Torak, the child of light and the child of dark. You embody those destinies.
But Torak's asleep.
Not anymore. When you first put your hand on the orb, the touch signaled his awakening. Even now he stirs on the edge of awareness, and his hand fumbles for the hilt of Srakgoru, his black sword.
Geryon went very cold.
Are you trying to say that I'm supposed to fight Torak alone?
It is going to happen, Belgarion. The universe itself rushes toward it.
You can gather an army if you want, but your army, or Torak's,
won't mean anything. As the Codex says, everything will be decided when you finally meet him. In the end, you will face each other alone. That's what I meant by an alternative.
What you are trying to say is that I'm supposed to go off alone and find him and fight him?
Geryon demanded incredulously.
Approximately. Yes.
I won't do it.
That's up to you.
Geryon struggled with it.
If I take an army, I'll just get a lot of people killed. And it won't make any difference in the end anyway.
Not the least bit. In the end, it will just be you, Torak, Srakgoru, and the Sword of the Riven King.
Don't I have any choice at all?
None whatsoever.
Do I have to go alone?
Geryon asked plaintively.
It does not say that.
Could I take one or two people with me?
That is your decision, Belgarion.
Just don't forget to take your sword.
He thought about it for the rest of the day. In the end, his choice was obvious. As evening settled over the gray city of Reva, he sent for Belgarath and Silk. There were some problems involved, he knew, but there was no one else he could rely on. Even if his power were diminished, Belgarath's wisdom made Geryon not even want to consider the undertaking without him. And Silk, of course, was just as essential. Geryon reasoned that his own increasing talent for sorcery could see them through any difficulties if Belgarath should falter, and Silk could probably find ways to avoid most of the serious confrontations. Geryon was confident that the three of them would be able to cope with whatever arose until they found Torak. He did not want to think about what might happen then. When the two of them arrived, the young king was staring out the window with haunted eyes.
"You sent for us?" Silk asked.
"I have to make a journey,"
Geryon replied in a scarcely audible voice.
"What's bothering you?" Belgarath said. "You look a bit sick."
"I just found out what it is that I am supposed to do, Grandfather."
"Who told you?"
"He did."
Belgarath pursed his lips.
"A bit premature, perhaps," he suggested. "I was going to wait a while longer. But I have to assume he knows what he's doing."
"Who is this that we are talking about?"
"Geryon has a periodic visitor," the old man answered. "A rather special visitor."
"That's a singularly unenlightening response, old friend."
"Are you sure you really want to know?"
"Yes, I think I do," Silk replied. "I get the feeling that I am going to be involved in it."
"You are aware of the prophecy?"
"Naturally."
"It appears that the prophecy is a bit more than a statement about the future. It seems to be able to take a hand in things from time to time. It speaks to Geryon on occasion."
Silk's eyes narrowed as he thought about that.
"All right," he said finally. "You don't seem surprised."
The rat-faced little man laughed.
"Belgarath, nothing about this whole thing surprises me anymore."
Belgarath turned back to Geryon.
"Exactly. What did he tell you?"
"He showed me the Mren Codex. Have you read it?"
"From end to end and backward and forward, even from side to side a couple of times. Which part did he show you?"
"The part about the meeting of the Child of Light and the Child of Dark."
"Oh, I was afraid it might have been that part," Belgarath said. "Did he explain it?"
Dumbly, Geryon nodded.
"Well,"
the old man said with a penetrating look,
"now you know the worst. What are you going to do about it?"
"He gave me a couple of alternatives. I can wait until we get an army together, and we can go off and fight back and forth with the Angoraks for generations. That's one way, isn't it?"
Belgarath nodded.
"Of course, that will get millions of people killed for nothing, won't it?"
The old man nodded again. Geryon drew in a deep breath.
"Or I can go off by myself and find Torak, wherever he is, and try to kill him."
Silk whistled, his eyes widening.
"He said that I did not have to go alone," Geryon added hopefully. "I asked him about that."
"Thanks,"
Belgarath said dryly. Silk sprawled in a nearby chair, rubbing thoughtfully at his pointed nose. He looked at Belgarath.
"You know that Polgara would skin the both of us, inch by inch, if we let him go off alone, don't you?"
Belgarath grunted.
"Where did you say Torak is?"
"Thal Mishrak, in Meloria."
"I have never been there."
"I have, a few times. It's not a very attractive place."
Maybe time has improved it.
Not very likely.
Sulk shrugged. Maybe we ought to go with him. Show him the way. That sort of thing. It's time I left Riva anyway. Some ugly rumors are starting to go around about me.
It is a rather good time of year for traveling, Belgorath admitted, giving Geryon a sly, sidelong glance.
Geryon felt better already. He knew from their bantering tone that they had already made up their minds. He would not have to go in search of Torak alone. For now, that was enough. There would be time for worrying later.
All right. What do we do?
We creep out of Riva very quietly, Belgorath replied. There's nothing to be gained by getting into any long discussions with your Aunt Paul about this.
Oh, the wisdom of the ages, Silk agreed fervently. When do we start?
His ferret eyes were very bright.
The sooner the better, Belgorath shrugged. Did you have any plans for tonight?
Nothing that I cannot postpone.
All right, then. We will wait until everyone goes to bed. Then we will pick up Geryon's sword and get started.
Which way do we go?
Sindaria first, Belgorath replied. And then across Drasnia to Garognadrach. Then north, to the archipelago that leads to Meloria. It's a long way to Khrol Mishrak and the tomb of the One-Eyed God.
And then?
Then, Geryon, we settle this. Once and for all.
Part 3. Drasnia. Chapter 17.
Dear Aunt Paul,
Geryon's note began,
I know this is going to make you angry, but there's no other way. I have seen the Mrin Codex, and now I know what I have to do.
He broke off, frowning.
How do you spell prophecy?
He asked. Belgorath spelled it out for him.
Don't drag it out too much, Geryon, the old man advised. Nothing you say is going to make her happy about this, so stick to the point.
Don't you think I ought to explain why we're doing this?
She has read the Codex, Geryon. She will know why, without your explanation.
I really ought to leave a note for Tenedra, too.
Polgara can tell her what she needs to know. We have things to do. And we cannot afford to spend the whole night on correspondence.
I've never written a letter before. It's not nearly as easy as it looks.
Just say what you have to say, and then stop, the old man advised. Don't labor at it so much.
The door opened, and Silk came back in. He was dressed in the nondescript clothing he had worn on the road, and he carried two bundles.
I think these should fit you, he said.
He handed one of the bundles to Belgorath and the other to Geryon.